Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for January the 7th. Coming up on this week's podcast, it's a mix of philosophy, faith and science as we explore Edge Magazine's New Year question and hear how the likes of Richard Dawkins and Steven Pinker admit to having had second thoughts on some of the doctrines they hold most dear. Also in the show, we'll discuss a new way to consider the links between science and religion with our guest, the cosmologist Stephen Phelps. Plus, at home with Hector, we pay a special visit to Britain's newest and fastest supercomputer, and we report from Virgin Galactic's European Mission Control and their planned trips to fly right into the Northern Lights. Think you've heard it all before? Well, think again. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Qantas never crashed and science never sleeps. Yes, this is our second show of 2008, although actually the New Year special we put out last week was kind of pre-recorded sometime in 1957 or something. So right here, right now with me in the pod and making his return to the microphone, it's Guardian science correspondent James Randerson. Angry New Year for you, James?
No, quite.
Chilled out, relaxed?
Well, actually quite warm by comparison with Northern Sweden.
Where were you?
Well, I was a lot warmer than I was in Northern Sweden.
I see. We'll hear about that later. We begin this year, as we did last year, with the Edge question. First, a little background. Edge.org is an online club of sorts for scientists, philosophers, artists, anyone who likes to think. Every year, it poses a question on its website and gathers responses from some of the world's greatest minds, people like Daniel Dennett, Susan Blackmore, Steven Pinker and Craig Venter, most of whom, by the way, have been on this podcast. We'll hear more from Edge's publisher, John Brockman, later in the programme. The question he asked this year was, what have you changed your mind about and why? And here's the statement it was based on.
When thinking changes your mind, that's philosophy. When God changes your mind, that's faith. When facts change your mind, that's science.
Obviously, Welsh there is the language of the intellectuals. And James, you are a Welsh person, aren't you? We'll go through a few of these. There's about 167 people who responded. We've mentioned some of the people already. What was your favourite?
Well, there's some pretty heavy stuff in there. So to start off with one that's probably more accessible than most, it's Helena Cronin, who's a philosopher at the London School of Economics. And she was talking about, why is it that men tend to dominate society? Why is it that, you know, the boardrooms are dominated by men, the Nobel Prizes are dominated by men, et cetera, et cetera?
And it's not just aggression, she's going to say.
No. I mean, she said she used to think it was essentially to do with men having an aptitude perhaps for certain traits, being more aggressive, perhaps being more ambitious, coupled with that elements of kind of discrimination in society, you know, a lack of childcare here, that kind of thing. But she's changed her mind and she thinks it's not about, it's not only about a kind of difference in the mean in the abilities of men and women. She doesn't think there is a difference, but she thinks there's a difference in the variance about the mean, if you like, in male and female abilities. So you get more men at the top tail of the distribution, if you like, the Nobel end of things, and you get more men at the other end of the distribution, the sort of dumbbell end of things, as she puts it. Whereas women tend to be more clumped in the middle. And so, you know, there are less, the fewer losers, but also fewer winners. And that's what explains it, she thinks.
Is that a little bit controversial? I mean,
I think it's extremely controversial.
That was more of a rhetorical question, I suppose, James. Is she kind of implying then that there's not a great deal that women can do in terms of getting ahead in boardrooms and that kind of thing?
Well, I don't know. She doesn't go a great deal into where this takes us in terms of public policy, except that she says that public policy is predicated on the fact that there isn't this difference, if you like. And so she implies that, you know, we need to change public policy in some way. But I think it's a really interesting idea. I think there's probably a lot of truth in the fact that, you know, there are more loser men out there. I mean, if you look at the number of criminals, the proportion of criminality amongst men and women, it's undoubtedly the case that men tend to be more violent and tend to commit more crimes and things like that. So, you know, maybe it's true at the other end, but it's an extremely controversial suggestion. And as you say, what does that mean in terms of public policy? It makes it quite difficult to improve the statistics in terms of the number of women there. I mean, what you could argue that all of this is amplified by discrimination as well. But actually, a lot of the answers to the questions are much more mind-expanding stuff and, you know, much more in philosophical realm. I mean, one of those was Rebecca Goldstein.
That's right, Rebecca Goldstein, philosopher at Harvard University. She was taking on Popper, Karl Popper, who is worshipped by most scientists as their sort of philosopher-in-chief, as it were. The idea of he came up with the idea of falsifiability, as a theory is not scientific unless you can find some way of falsifying it. And most scientists today will quote that to you as a way of describing how science works. If you can design a test to falsify something, then that's probably a scientific theory. She has some questions with it, though. She likes the idea of Popper. She says that she teaches it in her lessons. She teaches at Harvard University. So, for example, she said it was gratifying to see Popper used to discredit things like psychoanalysis and Marxism, both of which were claimed to be scientific theories at some point in time. But she questions whether Popper's sort of characterization of how science is practiced actually is real. So this cycle of conjecture and refutation, she says, bears very little relation to what goes on in the labs and in journals. So, you know, in most journals, you don't see scientists saying things like, for example, I try to refute this theory and it turns out that I was wrong. What they do is just move things along slightly. They publish another paper that proves probably what they knew before. And she also says that what happens now is that By using the Popperian sort of idea, you can say this is a scientific theory, but then that allows everyone with unscientific theories to get out of having to explain themselves. So you can say that they will say, well, for example, the belief in God or proof of God's existence. Well, I don't believe that God exists, but that's not a scientific theory, so I'm not going to argue with it in that sort of way. It made me think. This is the first time I've seen, I mean, I as a layman have come across a big challenge to the ideas of Popper. I'm sure lots of people come across this all the time. But what do you make of that?
I've started to go through the same transformation. I think I naively believed in the Popperian
ideal. Is Popper's crown falling?
I mean, for example, the name of the big physicist that we had in a while back talking about string theory.
Lee Smolin.
And he was saying that there isn't a simple way of refuting this hypothesis.
Absolutely.
And then you come, well, is this really science or not? There are other things in physics like that, that you know, you can't find a glib way of sort of refuting the hypothesis, but yet it's still part of the pantheon of science.
It's very embarrassing, isn't it, for physics? So you can't rationalise all these sorts of things like string theory, things like the rationalisation between the standard model and gravity, and whatever you're coming up with, what physicists are coming up with to replace these ideas is not refutable, because what their argument is that you haven't built some big enough machines to test it yet. They're always going to have something to say about this. And I mean, perhaps the only reason that they're scientific quotes is because there's something mathematical behind them.
I think there's also a lot in what you're saying about the way that people actually go about doing science is not in a Popperian way. And I wonder if it's more to it than just a kind of language thing, that people don't describe their experiments in those terms, but also, you know, you don't get negative results published. The vast majority of things in scientific papers are positive results that are supporting a theory rather than refuting a theory.
Absolutely.
And also, I mean, scientists are human beings, and very often they hang on to their theories a lot longer than perhaps they should. You know, they, even when the negative results come out, you can have people on different sides of a debate who are interpreting the evidence in entirely different ways, and it's not quite as clear cut. But, I mean, having said all of that, I think Popper's a pretty good place to start.
Clearly, lots to discuss there. Remember, you can talk about any of this stuff on our blog, blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Let's move on a bit to Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker, another friend of the pod, he talked in his answer about evolution, human evolution. Are we still evolving? He believed when he was writing The Language Instinct and so on a long time ago that we've kind of stopped evolving. There's not really much we can do to evolve our genes.
We're kind of stuck on the plains of
Africa. That's right. That's right. We were all bands of hunter-gatherers for a long time, and that the agricultural revolution and so on happened, but our genes didn't change. We just kind of, all our evolution and adaptation was cultural. That was his idea. But he admits in his answer, that was all written before the human genome was sequenced, and that since then there have been huge amounts of research to suggest that lots of genes are under strong selection and have been for the last 10,000 years, not the hundreds of thousands of years you expect genes to be sort of evolving over, but 10,000 years, which is a very short scale of time, James, isn't it, for evolution?
Yes,
given that I'm not an evolutionary biologist and you are, that's a short time, I believe. So yeah, he sort of says that he's more willing to believe this idea that we're still evolving. We talked about this recently, actually. Ian Sample, the other Guardian Science correspondent, he wrote a piece about this, that there are all sorts of genes for things like digesting milk or whatever that seem to be under strong selection. But for Pinker, something else interesting is happening. He's saying that as an evolutionary psychologist, he's very excited by this, and he calls the next stage of his subject evolutionary psychology on steroids. So he says, humans might have had evolutionary adaptations not just to the conditions that prevailed for hundreds of thousands of years, but also to some of the conditions that have prevailed for only a few millennia or even centuries. Currently, evolutionary psychology assumes that any adaptation to post-agricultural ways of life are 100% cultural. So it's exciting stuff.
I think that answer ties in quite well with Mark Pagels, who's an evolutionary biologist at Reading University. And he's talking about genetic differences between groups of humans. And he says social science has brought an overbearing censorship to the way we're allowed to think and talk about the diversity of people on Earth. And, you know, I think this is sort of tying in a bit with some of the themes that Jim Watson was sort of rather ham-fistedly touching on when he came over here to promote his book. But I mean, one of the things that Pagel says in his answer is, like it or not, there may be many genetic differences among human populations, including differences that may even correspond to old categories of race, in quotes, that are real differences in a sense of making one group better than another at responding to some particular environmental problem. This in no way says one group is in general superior to another or that one group should be preferred over another.
Just different.
But he's saying that there's been this kind of censorship within science at looking at this kind of question. And actually there's some interesting things going on there.
Isn't the interesting thing that there might be differences between groups? And those differences might be just some would make them better adapted to certain situations than others. But the problem we have with that is that then you get into this idea that people might argue that you're just being racist because you're arguing about differences between races. But actually, race is very tied up with things like skin color and location in the world. Whereas what this is suggesting is that it doesn't matter about your skin color. You might have different people in groups who look completely different but kind of are better at certain things than others.
Well, it's a very incendiary subject. I mean, I guess the reason for the caution and the self-censorship, perhaps, is the worry that even, you know, innocuous differences that scientists discover between groups will be jumped on by, you know, racist groups like the BNP or whatever and used to justify, you know, rather nasty ideas. So, you know, it's just a very difficult thing to talk about.
Just a reason to be more careful. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, perhaps. Okay, well, we're going to leave all of that there. It's a nice light topic to get us started, obviously. We're going to have more of the edge questions a bit later on, though. Remember, you can tell us exactly what you think about all of this on the blogs, on the Facebook wall, and you can also have a look at the full answers from Dawkins et al. On edge.org. Now, space is one of those topics we never tire of talking about here on Science Weekly, and not just because I want to be an astronaut when I grow up. Sorry, grow up more. That's why I was ever so slightly jealous that Randy Randerson got the opportunity to travel 200K north of the Arctic Circle to Sweden's Esrange Space Centre. The facility is already used by the European Space Agency to launch rockets and balloons that study the upper atmosphere and the effects of microgravity. If all goes well, by 2010, Esrange will also act as the mission control for the European outpost of Sir Richard Branson's space tourism project, Virgin Galactic. But James, first, Richard Branson's got an even more extraordinary offer for his prospective customers, hasn't he?
He has. The first flights are going to go up from a specially built spaceport in New Mexico. But what he's offering from Esrange, it's in Kiruna in northern Sweden, is a flight into the Aurora Borealis, into the Northern Lights themselves. And nobody's ever done that before.
So what are the Aurora going to look like to someone flying in them?
At Esrange, you know, they've been flying up sounding rockets, which are rockets that just go up and straight back down, since the 60s up into the Aurora to do various measurements. And, you know, so they know the sort of radiation levels and all this kind of thing. So, they're as convinced as they can be that it's going to be safe. But no one had ever thought of putting a camera on board up till now. In fact, later in the year, in November, they are going to put a rocket up with four cameras on board to see what it looks like from inside. You know, no human has flown through the Aurora Borealis either. So they've been seen from space, from the space station, from above, but no one's been inside. I spoke to Olli Norberg, who is director of Esrange, and he told me what it was going to be like to fly into the Northern Lights.
We've actually studied the details of this to see, is there any buildup of charges on the spacecraft, what is the radiation dose that you would receive. And those studies came out with it is completely safe to do this.
And what about the experience on the ground here? I mean, it's early days yet. You're still conducting this feasibility study, so you haven't started building a departure lounge or something like that. But what do you plan to have here, and what will the people experience when they come?
We are planning to use most of the existing facilities here in this area, such as the airport, the hangars, the operational facilities here at Esrange. But we are planning to establish a visitor center combined with a training center, where the people to be flying, the astronauts, will get their basic training for a couple of days into how to behave in the vehicle before, during and after their flight.
How long will that training take?
Well, it will take about 2 days. And during that period, you will get the basic training and the planning, because this is something very unique. You have to take good care of your few minutes in space and get the most of it. So that will be part of it too, to really plan and think ahead so you don't come up there and lose minutes. You will be well prepared. You will feel that every part of this mission, the G-force, is something you have expected.
And you couldn't put in a good word with Sir Richard, could you, for a ticket for The Guardian?
I hope so, yes.
Ole Norbury there, director of the Esrange Space Centre in Kiruna. So James, tell us what the place is actually like.
Well, yeah, I got shown around the place, and it's, I mean, the actual mission control room is incredible. It looks like a sort of cheap version of a James Bond set. There are kind of these blocky 60s consoles and things, and they've got buttons on them like liftoff that I couldn't...
Did you press it?
Well, I have to confess that I did, but it wasn't switched on. It was, well, nothing, because it wasn't switched
on. Launched, hasn't it?
Yeah. It was great fun, though. I mean, the place is amazing. I mean, it was clearly a kind of academic place. They had a kind of inflatable rocket in the corner of the room and things like that. So they weren't taking themselves too seriously. But yeah, from there, they send up these rockets. They also monitor polar orbit satellites, because they're so far north. They can be in contact with a satellite for kind of a much more time than if you're closer to the equator.
The tickets for Virgin Galactic there cost about 100 grand. So obviously the people up there are going to be rich. Going there are going to be rich. What else is there to keep their time occupied while they're there?
Well, yes, you might think that the icy wastes of northern Sweden might be a little bit lacking for those with a lot of cash to spend, but actually the ice hotel, the first ice hotel that was ever built in the world, is up there, and that's quite a kind of luxurious and expensive experience.
Did you go?
I did actually. I got to stay in the ice hotel.
Excellent. Is it cold?
Yes, it's absolutely freezing, yeah. Yeah, -5 degrees in the room, but you get a very warm sleeping bag, so it's very nice. And, you know, there's all sorts of other kind of nice kind of northern Nordic things to do, like going on dog sleds, which I also do.
Did you? Oh, that all sounds like enormous fun, James. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we'll be back on the Edge question in a bit and hear from the magazine's publisher, John Brockman, about faith, philosophy and science. Plus...
It has the ability to do something like 10,000 calculations per second for every person on the planet.
We meet Hector, Britain's newest and fastest supercomputer. First, though, if you've had the pleasure, indeed the joy, of listening to our review show over Christmas, you'll know that the topic that's dominated our podcast from 2007 was creationism versus evolution, or put it another way, God versus science. Now, you might be of the mind that you've heard it all before, but hold tight, dear listener. Stephen Phelps is our special guest this week, and he thinks that when it comes to this delicate matter, he has what politicians would describe the third way. He gave a lecture recently at Warwick University called Adversary or Ally, the Baha'i Faith and the New Atheism. Stephen, welcome. Now, you think that science and religion shouldn't be competing. Can you tell us why?
Well, they shouldn't be competing because ultimately what makes people think they compete is when they view religion as some sort of an arbitrary man-made construction of laws and institutions that have been given by some sort of higher being, whereas in reality, religion isn't evolutionary. It's an organic, it's a reality that gradually unfolds in the course of human history. And ultimately, this organic reality is not at all in contradiction with science.
So you're of the Baha'i faith. Can you tell us what Baha'ism, if that's the word, Baha'ism, is it?
The Baha'i faith.
The Baha'i faith. Can you tell us more about that?
Very briefly, although you can't really summarize such a large subject in a sentence or two, but very briefly, it's a worldwide fellowship of approximately 6 million people of a wide variety of races, of economic backgrounds, of religious backgrounds. And they're united in the belief, ultimately, that religion is something which is evolutionary, and that they believe ultimately that actually evolution is the founding premise of religion, that religious truth is relative, it's relative to time and place, and that religions appear in the world really according to the needs of time and place. And ultimately the purpose of religion is to push humanity to the next level of its collective consciousness. And that next level in its collective consciousness is the apprehension of its own unity, of its ultimate, of the ultimate unity of the human race.
James,
your thesis is sort of that this new atheism, if you like, needn't be in competition with religion. How do you see that happening?
Ultimately, we believe that it shouldn't be in competition with religion because we think that the very terms of the debate have been misdefined. Both parties in this debate seem to agree basically on the definition of God. They seem to basically agree on the definition of religion. They see God as some sort of a cosmic agent, more or less like you and me, but bigger and more powerful. And they see religion as this purely human construction, which is quite arbitrary and quite man-made. And actually, well, they're true within the definitions that they've given. It's true that the majority of people see God and they see religion in these terms. But from a Baha'i point of view, these are actually the wrong way to go about defining them. Baha'is see God, insofar as God can be spoken of at all, they see God as an absolutely unknowable essence that has that's beyond being and existence. It's beyond unity and plurality. It's beyond any kind of attribute that can be given. Because of that, there is no logical path to proving God's existence. So we would agree fully, I think, with the refutations that are given by Dawkins and others of proofs of God's existence, because ultimately we believe that this is a reality that can't be touched by the intellect.
So, in a sense, is a scientist a kind of a theologian, if you like, someone who is getting at the truth of God, but through a route which is different than, you know, it's just a different way of getting at the same thing.
In a sense, we believe that that's the case because we see ultimately that the sphere of what has traditionally been seen as God's action ultimately overlaps with the sphere of what has been seen as natural, as the operation of the natural world. In other words, God's will, if you will, ultimately looks the same as nature. And so the scientist who is investigating the laws of nature ultimately is investigating something which has sacred significance.
You said that the Baha'i faith followers would say to themselves that there are some things that are unknowable, that mm-hmm. go beyond our physical ability to explain. Mm-hmm. How does that fit with your day job as a scientist, though, as a physicist and a cosmologist? I mean, mm-hmm. in science, you might think there's lots of things you don't know, but mm-hmm. surely you can't say to yourself, I don't know that and never will. I mean, that would be going against the idea that you can try at least to crack every problem.
Of course. No, of course. As a scientist, you're not bound by any of those considerations. You're trying to explore
reality
as fully
as possible. How do
you rationalize that? I don't see the tension, actually. I mean, if there's... I think science should press forward as far as it can and discover the unknown as far as it can.
But then how can you say there are things that are unknowable? I mean, how do you know that?
How do you know that there are things that are unknowable?
Exactly. I'm using Donald Rumsfeld.
I was going to say unknowns.
But you know what I mean. I mean, yeah. So far, lots of things are unknowable, but from a scientific point of view, they can always be known, possibly. But what you're suggesting is you're going from the other end, which is that some things you're never going to be able to touch.
I'm not suggesting that science stop. I'm not suggesting that we say, well, science can't go to put some sort of limit on science and say there are certain questions that shouldn't be explored. Quite to the contrary, science should be perfectly free to explore all of these questions to the extent possible. It's my personal opinion, though, or my personal belief that ultimately questions such as existence versus non-existence are not going to be able to be answered within a scientific framework. Even the best science can do even now is you can talk about vacuum fluctuations in the universe coming forth from nothingness in that sense. But even in those sorts of theories, you still have to have some sort of framework of physical laws that this vacuum fluctuation occurs so that a universe can come into being. And ultimately, the existence of some sort of structured reality is something which which ultimately I don't think is going to have an answer.
Let me move on to politics now. Mr. Huckabee did particularly well in Iowa last week. There's a possibility, even however remote, fingers crossed, that there's going to be a creationist in the White House by the end of the year.
I think we've already got one.
What do you make of that?
What do I make of that? Oh my goodness. Well, basically, I think creationism and its sister theories like intelligent design are ultimately nonsense. But I don't think that has really a bearing on his viability as a political candidate.
Well, let's hope not. Stephen, thank you. Don't go anywhere, thanks, though, because we've got plenty more we want to ask you.
Hi, folks. This is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Now, depending on whether you were naughty or nice, you might have become the proud owner of a shiny new laptop, Xbox, iPhone, or some other gadgety gizmo over Christmas. Chances are, though, that it didn't cost £113 million. It isn't so big that it has to be kept in a sports hall, and it's not capable of 100 trillion calculations every second. Bobby Johnson, our tech guy, remember, told us about Hector, or the high-end computing terascale resource, to give him his less snappy name, in last week's show. But let me refresh your memory, and yes, I am going to refer to Hector as a he rather than an it. He's Britain's newest and fastest supercomputer. His processing power is equivalent to 12,000 normal desktops, and scientists hope to use him to simulate everything from climate change to financial markets. And he's a very sensitive lover. Only one of those statements is false, by the way. Amid much tight security and sliding door action, James went to Edinburgh to meet Arthur True, who's in charge of the project, or to put it another way, Hector's father. All right, producer Ben, I can't keep this up. Just play the damn clip, will you?
This is the Hector computational facility. It's a 60-frame Cray XT4. Each of the 60 different cabinets contains microprocessors, which have a total performance of around about a teraflop. So in total, 63 teraflops. What's a teraflop? A million calculations per second. So if you look at the Hector machine in front office here, it has the ability to do something like 10,000 calculations per second for every person on the planet.
That's remarkable.
The processors are so fast that between the time that a processor says, I've done this, and start to think about what I'm going to do next, light travels about that far, about 3 feet. So if you have a machine which is very big, then you never get the chance for one processor to say, here is the answer that you want, and get it to the other end of the machine in any sort of sensible time for the other processor to do something. That's why we try to cram the components as close together as we can to cut down on light travel time.
So it's so fast that the speed of light becomes a limiting factor.
It's very definitely a limiting factor.
That's absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
And this building, this facility, is not full of lots of scientists at their desks. They never come here. They simply access the computer via the internet.
Absolutely. Everything in this building is available over the internet to registered users. And there's no need for them to come here, and we don't particularly want them to come here. It keeps things much simpler if they do it from the comfort of their own offices.
And they sort of compete via grants and peer review of their plans, you know, the plans for their projects, over who gets to use the facility.
Yes, scientific excellence is the number one driver, and they will simply put in a research proposal which will be assessed for its scientific excellence and also its technical feasibility, and the best will get access.
And is that people all over the world?
No, the machines were bought by the UK taxpayer for UK science, and so although sometime we'll go to international collaborations or will be used for international projects, the vast bulk of it is for UK science.
A very excited, angry Randerson speaking with Arthur True there. James, what was the security like for this thing? Do you even know where it is now? Can you tell us?
They blindfolded me on the way there to make sure.
They probably did as well, didn't they?
I can't tell you. But, you know, it's just a very expensive thing, and they don't want some idiot, you know, trying to ram raid the building, even though there's probably nothing you could really sell on from it. But anyway, I mean, it's quite an impressive
beast. Tell us more about what it's going to do. I mean,
I was listening to the New Year show, and I mean, Bobby made quite a good fist on the admittedly rather sparse notes that I gave him. But I think you guys were a little bit disparaging about what it could do. Actually, it wasn't you. It was more Ian who was
having
a go.
Is this the best they can do with it? To remind listeners, yeah. Who's wondering, you know, is it the best they can do with it to model airflow?
Modeling airflow is one of them, which is actually an incredibly difficult problem to solve. And, you know, if we can make aircraft wings more efficient, then that's a great thing. But apart from that, all sorts of things like modelling the electrical activity of the heart so that you can intervene when it goes into fibrillation and stops working, essentially. Also, looking at financial markets, trying to predict the best strategy for a pension fund into the future that
is the
most...
fool's game, isn't it?
Well, probably, hopefully someone on the Guardian's pension fund is using Hector to predict which strategy to adopt in the future and what's most robust to different scenarios in the future of the financial markets. Also looking at climate change, trying to work out, I thought David would have liked this, but anyway, trying to look at, specifically the kind of local predictions. The computers we got at the moment are reasonably good at getting the global picture, but if you want to go down to kind of closer resolution of how that will affect things like the North Atlantic circulation in the ocean and how that will affect, the microclimate of Britain, then you really need much bigger computer power.
Stephen, do cosmologists use supercomputers?
Yes.
What do you use them for?
To some extent.
To model universes.
I use them to model the interactions of galaxies and the clustering of galaxies. Although, actually, at the level of the modeling that I do, I can do it on a regular laptop.
What would, for example, you need a supercomputer for if you wanted to measure modeling of 10 galaxies or something?
If you want to model the entire universe, that's what people are doing now. You model, say, 256 million particles, and you capture quite a good chunk of the visible universe that way. Each particle corresponds to a galaxy, and then you can actually look at the clustering properties of these galaxies. You can place the dark matter in relationship to the luminous matter and see how everything comes out of the equations. And then you compare that to reality, and that's actually what I do in my physics research, is I compare these simulations to actual observable, to the actual observations, and try to deduce things from them. Among the foremost of things, actually, that we want to find out is where this dark matter is that comprises so much of the visible universe.
It's one of our favorite topics, Dark Matter.
Yes, it's such a holy grail of cosmology. No one has any idea. It's just a crazy thing that 96% of the universe is an absolutely unknown substance. It's some combination of dark matter and dark energy. We can make simulations, create cosmological simulations to try to give us some sense of what the universe might look like with different mixtures of dark matter and dark energy and so forth, and then compare those to what we actually see, and then see how well they match up. So that's what I work with.
See, these things are very useful. I don't know what David was talking about last week. It's ridiculous. And Stephen, you should listen to Johnny Berliner's Dark Matter song to actually understand what dark matter really is. I think he cracked it last year in that song. All right, we're going to leave all that there. If you're interested in supercomputers and that kind of thing, you might be the sort of person who will get excited by our rather excellent new Tech Weekly podcast. It's riding high in the iTunes charts, and we like to think of it as our slightly geekier, younger cousin. Just remember, we started doing this sort of stuff first. At the beginning of the show, we talked about the Edge question, which this year was, what have you changed your mind about and why? Well, let's hear from the man who posed this fiendish question in the first place. John Brockman's the publisher of Edge.org. I spoke to him earlier and asked him to give us some of his highlights from this year's crop of answers.
Stuart Brand is, I would say, my oldest friend and colleague. He has done a 180-degree turn as the publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog, which originally came out in 1968. He helped define a whole generation of back to the earth, people concerned with tools, with the environment. And his essay is entitled, Good Old Stuff Sucks. Basically, he's saying in the 90s, I was praising the remarkable grassroots success of the building preservation movement, keep the fabric and continuity of the old buildings and the neighborhood alive, revive those sash windows. As a landlocked youth in Illinois, I mooned over the yacht sales pictures in the back of the sailboat books. I knew what I wanted, a gaff-rigged catch. Wood, of course. Only later did he find out that gaff-rigs couldn't sail windward. They leaked. The decks were a maintenance nightmare. He learned that fiberglass hulls that we'd all sneered at was superior in every way to wood. So not only is he changing his mind about his personal technologies, but much further, he's turned 180 degrees around vis-a-vis his leadership of the environmental movement, calling for nuclear energy, which is an apostasy to his followers. So in a sense, he's just turning his back on the people that he's helped, the group that he's helped to create, and moving forward.
John Brockman there, and once again, you can read more at edge.org. One of the other respondents, of course, was Richard Dawkins. Where would we be without one of his answers to things? He talked about the importance of being open-minded and why it's important for scientists to change their minds sometimes. So here's a little excerpt. When a politician changes his mind, he's a flip-flopper. Politicians will do almost anything to disown the virtue, as some of us might see it, of flexibility. Margaret Thatcher said, "This lady's not for turning." Tony Blair said, "I don't have a reverse gear." Leading Democratic presidential candidates, whose original decision to vote in favour of invading Iraq had been based on information believed in good faith, but now known to be false, still stand by their earlier error for fear of the dread accusation, flip-flopper. How very different it is in the world of science. Now, let me ask you both here in the pod today, why is it important, Stephen, for scientists to remain open-minded? And as 167 philosophers and scientists have admit that you can be wrong sometimes.
Well, that's the whole basis of science. I mean, you have to be able to accept whatever conclusions may come. And I would add out, actually, that it also ought to be the same, precisely the same attitude that people come at from the perspective of religion. Unfortunately, that's not the case. But people should be just as willing to change their religious beliefs on the basis of evidence, either from science or from any other source, as well as scientists. It's just a matter of searching for truth. It's a matter of that search for truth is, and that position should be completely independent of whether you're a scientist or a religious believer or whatnot.
The search for truth, I suppose, in this case, starts from, I don't know the answer. Let me find out what the answer
Absolutely.
Is. Here's my position right now. In mm-hmm. the future, it might be different. And you're
Absolutely.
Saying that's the same for religion.
That
and,
should
and
be.
So on.
It should be. And to the extent that it's not, I think that's what's wrong with religious believers today.
But I think we come back to Helena Cronin here, that the reality of science sometimes doesn't live up to this sort of ideal either. Because very often scientists cling to ideas way past their sell-by date when the evidence is pointing in a different direction. You know, scientists are human and they don't always follow this credo.
And will follow things, as you say, incorrectly for a long time. And it can sometimes, scientific theory sometimes can progress simply on the reputations of scientists rather than
Indeed, indeed. And although you have a lot of scientists here admitting to a change of mind, you know, if scientists change their mind all the time, I don't think they'd have very much professional credibility.
So it is refreshing, though, to see all of this, this sort of humbleness, this sort of humble pie that they started eating. I think it's quite nice, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, yeah,
I don't understand half the answers myself, but...
Well, some of them are pretty heavy, but yeah, they're worth reading two or three times, I think.
All right, well...
That's your homework for next week.
Well, I'm going to start reading today, and hopefully I'll get through them by the end of the week. Okay, well, that's it from us for our very first proper show of 2008. I can fairly say we've touched on every single big topic in one show. God, creationism, evolution, dark matter, the universe, whether we're alone or not, all of that stuff. And we're going to continue for the rest of the year. So my thanks to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, and our special guest, Stephen Phelps. If you want to add your thoughts and opinions to anything you've heard on the show, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post a comment on our Facebook wall. You've been writing some very complimentary things there in the past few weeks, so thank you very much indeed. And by the way, if you liked what you've heard here, then check out the rest of The Guardian's audio output at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. Science Weekly has been produced, as ever, by Ben Green. I'm Alok Jha, and it's always, always a pleasure.
Guardian Unlimited.